Welcome to the Reason Round Table, where the editors of the world's most sans-serif libertarian magazine gather each Monday to commiserate in a caffeinated way about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and boss lady Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy post-Easter and Passover, my belieber friends.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Christ is risen.
Thank you. Hallelujah. We're going to talk about rolling away the stone and the stolen body hypothesis, and actually some stuff about Georgia voter laws.
You know, I think Russia's fingerprints are all over that stone.
Oh, yeah. Welch. Yeah.
I just hope we get into some Shroud of Turinology here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shroud of Turin. Come on, what chemtrails next, Peter?
That was the era of Rush that I liked the best when they were getting into the Shroud of Turin. But anyways, first, before we get into any of that, it's the premium exclusive is always the pre-chat, as you can imagine. But anyways, first, on October 2nd, 2018, respected Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. He was never seen alive again. At a time when America is focused on its own domestic crises, there is one movie reminding us that there are unbelievable and shocking events unfolding across the globe. The new documentary, The Dissident, boldly looks into the events and intrigues surrounding the murder that shocked the world. The movie not only unearths new proof, it ultimately exposes Khashoggi's killers. Senator Rand Paul states, the evidence is overwhelming that the Crown Prince was involved. Senator Lindsey Graham says, there's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. The Associated Press calls The Dissident a real-life thriller playing out at the highest levels of power and wealth. Are you ready for the truth, Nick Gillespie? From the Academy Award-winning director of Icarus comes The Dissident, now playing at home on demand. Visit thedissident.com for more information. That is thedissident.com. Watch it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, since the last time this podcast convened in my absence, Major League Baseball, at the urging of President Joe Biden and former President Barack Obama and such multinational behemoths as Delta and Coca-Cola, decided to move its midsummer All-Star Game festivities out of Fulton County, Georgia, where the Braves play, in protest over the Peach State's new voter laws, which were broken down in this space last week. This move, which not insignificantly was opposed by many of the same Georgia-based activists who were otherwise been criticizing the voting law, created some new backlashes of its own, predictably, including former President Donald Trump calling basically for the boycott of most sports, and Georgia legislators voting to raise taxes on Delta. Meanwhile, did we mention that the 2022 Winter Olympics are being held in Red China? Nick Gillespie, Catherine, as the non-sports baller here, even more so than Peter, can you help us structure our thinking, our hierarchy, our libertarian hierarchy of hatreds here? Who gets the biggest raspberry in the story so far?
Libertarian hierarchy of hatreds is absolutely how I start my week every Monday. So this is a perfect question for me. So we talked about this issue on the podcast last week more broadly. We talked about the sort of effort to change the ways that voting works in a bunch of states. And my position at the time, which is still my position, is that in general, libertarians should oppose laws which restrict or make it more difficult to vote for partisan reasons. Now, there are lots of ways that people do that all the time, including gerrymandering, including all kinds of other things. This is just one mechanism. The fact that it has a potentially has a racially disparate impact is worth considering and thinking about. It is, I think, a serious concern given our country's history with racist and racialized voting laws. However, I think this week this topic tipped right on over into just full-on motivated partisan reasoning. I think we stopped talking about the thing and started talking about which team we were on, and now people are just shouting red and blue at each other. And some corporations chose to shout either red or blue, and they should not be surprised when people on the other team get mad.
Is that who's playing in the All-Star game, the red team and the blue team?
Right. I mean, this is, I think, as far as I can tell, the difference between how this conversation is now going and how it will go in the stands at the sports ball game is almost indistinguishable.
Nick, you remember that the red and blue were the actual colors back when the NBA had East and West All-Star
teams. For sure. Matt, and I want you to work in immediately a Pete Rose, Ray Fosse metaphor.
It's with us in spirit forever. I want to invite you, Nick, actually, as the as my ally here, and thank you for your allyship. But I want to invite you to respond to a conservative complaint.
As the Secretary General of the John Bacabella Baseball Fan
the
Club.
Biff Pokoroba Baseball Fan Club. So the conservative complaint you hear at times like this is like, hey, the entire culture is against us. They are pushing our noses in our politics, or pushing our political differences in such a way that all non-political spaces like sports, like fizzy drinks, whatever, is marching through the institutions and making us feel like we're jerks everywhere. So because this is what they do in their totalitarian light type of ways. How do you respond to that critique?
Well, part of me is like I agree with the great sports writer Robert Lipsight, who is one of the first kind of mainstream guys to talk about this. No, sports is not some little treehouse or clubhouse that a bunch of boys go to that's divorced from everything else that's going on in the world. It is a reflection, an instantiation, an extension of all of the stuff that's going on everywhere, and so like to be complaining, the Olympics are being politicized. The Olympics were created by a French loser, or rather a Frenchman who was upset that the French had gotten their asses kicked in the Franco-Prussian War and hence came up with a new battle that the French might beat the Germans on, which they did actually for a while, not so much by the time, in the late Cold War and whatnot. But sports is always politicized and whatnot. What I'm interested in is, when people, two key things, I guess, just to keep it somewhat limited. One is that even Stacey Abrams, the Georgia politician, who many people believe, and she certainly does, was, had a stolen election against her a few years ago as governor of Georgia. She was pissed that the All-Star Game's leaving Atlanta. So it's like something weird is going on here, and we should keep that in mind. But then the other thing is we should be focusing on, what are the questions about voter rights and voter turnouts and things like this? Partly as a result of this, one of the things I looked into, because Chuck Schumer, my senator in New York, wrote saying, hey, we're happy to have the All-Star Game come to New York. He didn't specify, because he's a politician, he didn't specify which stadium it would be in New York or anything like that. But he said, because we like respect voting rights and stuff like that. And it's, I checked that New York State had a 63.6% voter turnout rate in 2020. Georgia had 67.7%. Georgia, if our measure of how great and wonderful and fresh smelling a state is the percentage of voters who come out in presidential elections, Georgia has been doing a better job at turnout every election since 2004, better than New York. I want to have a better conversation about what are voter kind of election laws doing. And then also, and this is part of the, a reason angle or a libertarian angle, we know what they're written to do. And I have every reason to believe the Republicans, who are idiots, think that suppressing voter turnout will help them. They're wrong about that by objectively. But what is the effect of voter laws? Because somehow Georgia, which, this is the second coming of Jim Crow. This is Jim Crow 2.0 people were talking about.
Jim Eagle.
Somehow. Yeah, well, Jim Eagle is for northern states, I believe. But somehow Georgia has been doing better in getting more people, a larger percentage of eligible voters, to the polls in presidential elections than New York City since 2004. So whatever you do, I guess what I'm saying is don't take the All-Star Game to New York and maybe take it to California, which had a much higher rate of voter
California
turnout.
California is never hosting a large gathering ever again, according to their COVID policies.
A couple of years down the road to the Olympics.
Yeah, Nick they'll in a room by himself in California might actually be violating their gathering laws right now.
Yeah.
It'll just be me and Gavin Newsom. We'll have Dodger Stadium to ourselves.
You can maybe have it catered by French Laundry. It'll be great.
Couple of things before I
do. They do outdoor dining though at French Laundry? I think they only do indoor.
It's the experience.
Before I pass it to Peter, one possible explanation for Georgia's high voter turnout is that it's a contested state. There's a lot
of course,
the Senate, yeah. the so, president.
And so then what does it say that New York is not contested? It means that people who want to vote for somebody else don't even bother. What a shame.
Or you can let me finish the thought, Nick.
I don't have all day.
There's the contested stuff, but as someone who votes, unlike Catherine, and has tried to vote in New York City and state, the voting laws here are objectively terrible. Like, they're really, really hard. The registration deadlines are all per quacky. It is a really bad place to vote. They've made it incrementally better. And also their counting is abysmal. They were still counting votes 2-3 months after
Election. Fiorella LaGuardia. Place. We're still seeing where he is in like District 13 of Brooklyn.
I mean, this actually is sort of a little tricky thing that is happening in all these conversations, which is, everybody in theory agrees that what we're trying to do is have accurate, fair elections where people have easy access to the polls. And the fight is weirdly about a bunch of empirical questions. Is there, in fact, widespread voter fraud? Is it, in fact, difficult to vote? Is it more difficult to vote for some people? And the fight is happening actually largely on that level. But we lack good information in some cases, or people are unwilling to hear information in other cases. And so, as I say, it ends up just being no red, no blue.
Suderman, I've seen a lot of commentary along the lines of which, like, it's obvious that none of you people have read this stuff, have read the bill. Like Thomas Boswell, who Nick will recognize the name and the you two won't, said something like, this is the most significant step Major League Baseball has taken since they integrated baseball in 1947. And it's just like, you didn't read any of this. One question.
Matt, if I may, just to annoy our younger, less sports interested
already
colleagues,
annoyed.
My Boswell is Ken Boswell, Matt Welch.
Thank you.
Not Tom Boswell.
My Boswell is
Ken Boswell. He created a miracle.
My Boswell is Bosley from Charlie's Angels. Peter, is one lesson here that in the overly nationalized, federalized way that we look and talk and argue about politics, and in fact, unfortunately, do a lot of journalism, is one lesson just like stop having parachuted in political beliefs that you can cut and paste onto a local conflict?
Yeah, I think that's a lesson. Another lesson is nobody reads the bill ever. Nobody in Congress, nobody in Georgia, nobody on this podcast. Have you read the bill? I haven't read the bill. Nobody reads the bill.
I read Elizabeth Nolan Brown's breakdown of it. It was good. And then Matthew Harwood's
piece of it. And that's useful. And in fact, most people don't need to read the bill. But what that results in is a lot of confusion about what's actually in the bill. So one of the provisions that has gotten the most attention is the you can't give people water while they're standing in line to vote provision. And everybody is saying, look, this is about making it really hard and arduous and awful to vote. It's about punishing voters. And therefore, the marginal voters are not going to show up. And that's, theoretically, in this narrative, that's going to help Republicans. But in fact, what that rule is about preventing activists from giving out water, with a vote for this guy or a paid for by your local activist organization that obviously you would know supports X candidate, written on the bottle of water. In fact, you can distribute water, but it's got to go through poll workers and be sort of neutral. And it's not that people can't have water in line. And so there's been this huge uproar over this, that just is way out of proportion to what the actual language of the text says, because
wouldn't
nobody
reads it.
Wouldn't it
be great if they were like, you can't have soda stream. You can have seltzer water, but it can't be soda stream. Because then that's like a Zionist.
You can't have Coke because Coke has endorsed the
You can't fly to your polling place on Delta. LaCroix here.
They just mix it all together and
give
you a cup of
something. But not other forms. Then we end up with stuff like threats, like Delta, complaining about this, and then the Republican House threatening to eliminate Delta's tax credit, which is like, you know, in our hierarchy of libertarian hatreds here, right? Who do you hate the most? Because like, I don't love this as a form of political and cultural retribution. That's a bad reason to make tax policy. On the other hand, it's also bad tax policy. And Georgia's tax policy is just chock full of provisions like this. Industry handouts that just end up going to very, very big, very connected businesses. So for example, since you got to talk about sports for the first 20 minutes of this podcast, I'm going to talk about something that other people care about, which is the freaking Avengers. The Avengers. So Disney, which owns Marvel and Star Wars and all of that, also does a ton of business in Georgia. And the reason they do is because the state has a gigantic tax credit that basically ends up funneling taxpayer funds into film budgets to offset the price of $100 million movies that go on to make billions and billions of dollars at the box office. So I've been not just movies, television shows that go on streaming services that have millions and millions of subscribers and are quite successful, like Disney Plus. I've been watching Falcon and the Winter Soldier over this last weekend. And
wow, you are smuggling every a whole episode, kind of caravan of stuff.
Yeah,
in,
at the
under
end of every
blank.
Episode, there is a big Georgia Film Commission logo, right? It's the that's the post-credit scene is we shot all of this in Georgia using taxpayer money. And so here's my answer to all of this. End the film tax credit. Georgia taxpayers don't need to chip in for the cost of the next X-Men film, which I'm really looking forward to.
You know, I liked it, Matt, when baseball was a game. You know, and it was just a bunch of kids without adults going into the sandlot in the backyard.
The cornfields.
You know, at
there.
The unfishing construction site or the old chemical plant. And, you know, just hit the bean around for a little bit.
I would love it to get to a point where I never hear James Earl Jones saying baseball in an advertisement again, which is from Field of Dreams.
What if
which
he
is
saying it from the
worst and most cynical movie ever made?
What if he's saying it as Darth Vader?
An indictment of baseball, the 60s.
In a Disney-financed Star Wars film, one-third of which has been paid for by Georgia taxpayers.
I want to pivot to the...
But can we, if I may, Matt Welch, just... I don't think there's anything wrong with politicizing sports, but then don't cry when people stop attending sports and don't cry. You know, like baseball, it's also it's just kind of great. Like, it isn't like they were doing gangbusters before this and they're going to have their first big marquee event after, you know, a lockdown and all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, this is the type of national sports franchise or, you know, league leadership. You see this in the NFL. You see this in the NBA. You've seen this on a planetary level with the Olympics, where these smug, mostly stupid and complacent legacy institutions, you know, are just not really thinking about the future because they're idiots. And
yeah,
it's a shame because the people who enjoy the sport and the people who play it, you know, that's a different thing.
Thank you for that observation, Nick. I would also add that culturally, baseball is as large in the southeastern part of the United States as anywhere else in the country at this point. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I want to pivot to the eternal recurrence of Infrastructure Week, obviously. I was just trawling the news today for catching up on things I missed while I was gone. And these were some of the headlines I read about the president's gargantuan new spending proposal. Biden announces huge infrastructure plan to, quote, win the future, unquote. This is Amtrak's new dream map after Biden's infrastructure push. This one just came up this morning. I'm especially excited about it. Buttigieg says infrastructure plan will cut deficit, quote, by year 16. Unquote. And my personal favorite, perhaps even more, how Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan seeks to achieve racial justice. It's hard to know where to begin with what would, I believe, I haven't checked, but I believe would be even adjusted for per capita inflation and everything else you want, the largest non-emergency spending bill in American history. But Peter, why don't you hive off some bit of awfulness from this $2 trillion thing?
I mean, there is $20 billion to advance racial equity and environmental justice in this bill, but that's not what I'm going to talk about.
Solved!
Right? That's there you go.
Next.
It's done. So
Matt, we're going to get Matt one of those
poverty
big,
in half.
One of those big stamps. It's going to be like solve. Thump.
I like that. There's a good that's going to sound great on my subwoofer. So last year, I think Biden promised to be the most pro-union president. And he has spent the first couple months in office rewarding his labor allies. I actually think the place to start in thinking about the infrastructure bill is with the $1.9 trillion recovery bill that already passed. And the single most unnecessary and egregious provision in that bill, which was full of unnecessary and egregious provisions, was an $86 billion bailout to union pension funds. No excuse for it at all. Had absolutely nothing to do with coronavirus relief or recovery, not even a sort of fig leaf of an excuse, right? And that bill also spent a bunch of money on schools, more than $100 billion in theory, under the arguments that the funds were desperately necessary to reopen schools right now, except that most of the money, just like the vast majority of it, is not going to be spent for years down the road. And so most of that money is just going to end up going to funding public sector union jobs and sort of associated priorities. And so now we have the infrastructure bill. And in a lot of ways, it's more of the same. This is a handout to Biden's union allies. And so you have a number of provisions and expectations built into this infrastructure plan. You have the Buy American provision, which means basically that we're going to have to do everything by buying domestically, which, of course, makes it much more expensive. So taxpayers are not going to get the same bang for their buck because of this. You have a prevailing wage rule, which basically means that all wages on these the projects that this funds are going to have to be paid at union rates, which again just makes things more expensive and means you may as well just go ahead and hire the union labor. And then you have the right to work, the repeal of right to work laws in 27 states. Those laws prohibit unions from charging dues to non-members. Right. So the whole idea of right to work is if you're not a union member, you shouldn't have to pay union dues. And Biden's proposal here as part of the infrastructure plan is to get rid of that. And it's really telling, I think, that Biden is not calling this the Rebuild America plan or the plan for more roads and bridges and some other stuff that we're going to call infrastructure, even though it's not really infrastructure. He's calling it the American Jobs Plan. And specifically, I think it is a jobs plan for union members at taxpayer expense. And it's also going to end up not creating the number of jobs that something like this could create if it weren't so focused on funneling money to unions. States with right to work laws, just to name one example, have actually seen manufacturing employment, the thing that we're supposed to be, you know, sort of boosting here, grow more than twice as fast over the past decade or so when compared to states without right to work laws. And so what Biden is doing here is proposing just a big bucket of money to go to union allies. Basically, and look, that's what he said he was going to do. He's fulfilling, you know, campaign trail promises here, but it's going to come at taxpayer expense. I think it's going to ultimately be worse for the economy, and I don't think it's going to create nearly as many jobs as he's promising.
Catherine, I heard Richard Blumenthal, one of our very worst senators from Connecticut, on my car radio yesterday, and it was amazing. He was saying, "Yes, this is this bill is going to be great because we're going to create, you know, five million new green jobs that are going to be cleaner because of the technology. He was saying the same damn stuff that we heard the Obama Bidens saying in 2007 and 2008, none of which came true. None of which came true.
Yeah, but they only spent $900 billion or so last time. This time they're going
to
get it right.
They didn't have the boldness that Joe Biden's bringing to the White House.
But also the centrism. The boldness and the centrism.
Catherine, am I becoming an anarchist?
I hope so. Your daughter is, according to the social media.
Could you believe that?
God bless her. So about this point in the conversation, I find that the word jobs stops sounding like a word. Like, do you ever have that problem where, like, you say the word a bunch of times and then it stops having meaning? And, like, when Nancy Pelosi...
Right? They're going to smurf a smurfing
they're
smurf.
They're going to smurf, smurf, green smurfs, and the smurf... Yeah. Nancy Pelosi in particular has this way of just saying the word jobs so many times that it loses its meaning. yeah, this is a jobs bill, not an infrastructure bill. But as Peter rightly points out, it's not actually a very good jobs bill. It's a different kind of jobs bill than the bill you might write if you wanted more Americans to have jobs. And of course, this is in the background of jobs. This is in the background of the fact that we are right now paying a lot of people not to work still. And we are still debating whether we should keep paying more people to not work. That conversation is not over. It's very not over.
And even in the midst of that, we just had an outstanding jobs report that way
we actually have a lot of jobs. The jobs are jobbing. The jobs are out there just jobbing out all over the place. And yet we need to pay $1.9 trillion for like sort of Amtrak, but also definitely jobs.
No,
and
no, this one's $2.2 trillion. We already did the $1.9
trillion. Oh, God. Sorry. Yep. It's more trillions.
Smurf.
And as Veronique DeRougy rightly points out in her column for the site that's on the site right now, you know, we are doing just a tremendous, tremendous amount of subsidizing Americans to not work. The Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis says that wages and salaries were roughly $37 billion lower in November of 2020 than in February of 2020, which means that there's just billions and billions, hundreds of billions of salary losses while we are. Yeah, but that number is much, much smaller than what we are paying people to not work. The individual stimulus distributed by Congress. We are paying people much more than they have lost in wages, and we want to continue to do so. Matt, I just want to throw one more headline into your pile of headlines that you missed. Biden's New Deal, : reengineering America, comma, quickly.
Quickly?
Quickly. And
a quick re-engineer, retro.
Well, he doesn't have a lot of time.
And that was on
left.
Top of, I believe, an Axios article that he doesn't have time. He needs to move quick. That was on top of an Axios article, which also contained this sentence. President Biden recently held an undisclosed East Room session with historians that included discussion of how big is too big and how fast is too fast to jam through once in a lifetime historic changes to America. No,
Nick.
That I
sounds
want
like
to,
a penthouse
Nick,
forum.
No, thank you.
I was going to congratulate you preemptively, Nick, of not taking the bait as a New Jersey piece of trash, and then you took the bait.
He did.
And I love it.
That article's so great because it's like, well, all the historians in the room were like, now is the time to go big, and Biden was like, yeah, I agree.
I love those kind of meetings. I have those meetings. I'm going to start having meetings like that where I just call in a bunch of people to tell me I should do exactly what I want all the time.
Hey, Nick, can you fling poo at Pete Buttigieg, please?
You know, I would choose not to because he's America's mayor now that Rudy Giuliani is in rest care at Arkham Asylum somewhere. But Buttigieg, has become the point man for the high-speed rail dream, which, you know, like if you have a dream, why not dream of like being able to fly or, you know, I don't know, like, you know, or being 6 feet tall
or
something.
You literally can't fly instead of taking high-speed rail. Like it's not a dream.
I mean, like, you know, being able to just like have a jetpack or something instead of talking about high speed rail. And, you know,
we're not going to be able to fly after Delta loses its Georgia tax credit.
Yeah, that's true. You know, well, you can buy America Airlines house wine because they're selling that because they don't fly a lot anymore. So you can actually buy the wine that American Airlines serves on its flights. But, part of one of the things that is shameful about all of this kind of infrastructure stuff is that, of course, you know, Joe Biden is Senator Amtrak. He loves trains. He loves high speed rail. He loves low speed rail. And Pete Buttigieg has talked about how, you know, putting together a national high speed rail program would be really great. It's the last thing, you know, that we need to do to really achieve racial equity is to have a money losing line that goes at almost 70 miles an hour from St. Louis to, Reno, Nevada or something like that. And it is stunning because this is, you know, railroads are a 19th century technology that we have moved beyond in so many ways. They're great for hauling freight, not so great for hauling people in a country like this. We replace them with automobiles very successfully and with airplanes, but we keep coming back to it. There's hundreds of billions of dollars across different platforms in the infrastructure bill to deal with transportation, with this and with that, to help Amtrak, all of that kind of stuff. And what I would just point to people point people to is Paul Dietrich of Reason TV put out on Friday a great kind of catch-up piece of like back in the early Obama administration, Joe Biden was the high-speed rail czar. And he touted about what was going to happen in California, where, you know, and the Obama administration kicked over $8 or $10 billion for high speed rail stuff. In California, there is a non-working, short line of high speed rail, which will never be completed, which has ballooned to something like 100 times its original cost. And it's laying there. And if you're not doing it in California, you're probably not doing it anywhere else. So watch the Reason TV video about the California high-speed rail project and what that indicates for the rest of the country, which is that we're never going to have a high-speed rail, and that's not a bad thing.
I just think it's a huge problem that there's no funding for a Hyperloop.
Which is probably a scam, by the way, also.
Monorail 2.0. That will take you at 800 miles an hour.
Yeah,
from place
that's why
to
they're
place
everywhere. It's such a good idea that nobody wants to build one, actually, right?
Unlike Peter Suderman's Hyperloop dreams, the Reason Foundation, which makes this podcast and Reason Magazine possible, is a living rebuke to the idiotic social media retort of, "Oh, you libertarians, you just hate all transportation." Bob Poole, who should be on Mount Rushmore, has done more important and influential work on transportation policy in America than just about any other living human being. Go to reason.org, click on the issues tab of transportation. I think maybe just straight to transportation gets you there, and you'll see all kinds of incredibly useful, practical studies and tips and all this kind of stuff. And if you're not fluent in it and you think you're having intelligent argument about transportation policy, I challenge that assertion, frankly. I will say one other thing about transportation before we pivot to a mid-show advertisement, which is...
Before we move this train along?
Which is... that's the third rail of commentary What? Yeah, why not? It's this. Donald Trump was rightly mocked for always having Infrastructure Week and such like. Point out this. He, in one of those iterations, said, here's my $1 trillion plan, which is originally supposed to be $500 billion plan, of which I believe $200 billion was going to be actually spent by the federal government, which is already a lot and probably too much money. But the other $800 trillion was going to be basically the federal government getting out of the way in areas that it currently is in the way of and allowing for private capital to move in and help create projects on a for-profit basis. It's the kind of stuff Bob Poole's been advocating for years. And the Democrats rejected it out of hand, not at all on the pluses and minuses of doing this. It's just that they wanted to be in control of spending all $1 trillion. Go look at the quotes at the time, especially from Chuck Schumer. It's like, no, we need to be directing that spending. Tells you everything, I think, including feeds back to what Peter was saying earlier about the purpose of this and other bills. It's to reward their donor constituencies. And I don't like to come up with that conclusion. I want to think better of everyone, even politicians. And it's just becoming more and more difficult. Okay.
Matt, if I may, I think that Biden, though, he's not cynical in the sense that he is not, you know, I mean, his actions are terrible, but he really believes this. And what I see in him, you know, this is a guy who came into political office, you know, at the beginning or in the thick of the Great Society programs, before those were completely revealed to have not done what they were going to do. They didn't cut child poverty. They spent a lot of money. They screwed up the economy. I think he is of a mindset that is the one that is discussed in Amity Schley's recent history of the Great Society and its failures, which is a book that was written before the 2020 election or published before the 2020 election. It's so important. And what she says is that there was a post-war consensus or a building consensus that took a time to get to where everybody was like, okay, we have beaten the kind of market, the economy. We realize we know how to have money and growth and wealth without end. And now the function of government for the first time in human history, after the Depression, you know, after centuries of poverty, after the Depression, after World War II, you know, we won all these things, is to distribute things more, more fairly, and to create the world that we all want, meaning the elites want. And we can do it without any worry that, like, we're going to run out of money or that the economy is going to tank, et cetera. And that's the mindset that I see in a lot of this stuff. And the difference between Biden and Obama is that Biden started before the 70s slog and the Reagan revolution and stuff. And I think, like, something got stuck there, and he's still thinking it's 1969 and that the future is bright and that we don't have to worry about things, you know, that Joseph Schumpeter and other people talked about, how, you know, the really difficult thing is to constantly be creating wealth and innovating technology and other forms of business that give what people's ever-changing demands want. And this to me is the real hubris, and it's going to come a cropper.
We're going to go to listener email here in a second. If I don't sneeze, I might sneeze. Although, you know, you're not supposed to sneeze when you're like, there's a reason why people don't sneeze when they're on television. Like, something about the speaking, I'm talking my way out of a sneeze right now. Speaking in a high profile or whatever moment tells your nose to not sneeze. It's a true fact. Anyways, word from our sponsors, you guys missed me, I can tell, is something besides me not sneezing interfering with your happiness and your goals? Let's get you to start living a happier life beginning today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable and get instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com. That's H-E-L-P, like what Tony La Russa needs to find his way out of the 1980s, has helped more than 1 million people take charge of their own mental health. Listeners to this here roundtable get a special deal, 10% off in your first month. BetterHelp.com is more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Financial aid is also available. And soon, hopefully, that depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, whatever, will be in the rearview mirror. So go to their website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and desires. You'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, switch them out. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Listener email of the week. Reminder, send your questions, preferably brief, to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Kevin in Cedar Rapids. You know, that name has always struck me as odd, because you don't think of, like, Rapids and Cedar in the same sentence. Anyways, Kevin asks, Dear Roundtable, with the continued rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine, we've had more groups of people become available to take it. Some, like myself, he says, have been excited to get it. However, others have said they will not. What are the levers, or even levers, that libertarians would pull, or buttons libertarians would push, to get people to take the vaccine? Thanks, and I love the podcast as well as the magazine. The Burn After Reading issue from July 2018 is one of my all-time favorites. I'm totally in favor, by the way, this is me talking now, of people mentioning stuff like that in their otherwise brief letters, questions. Suderman, you want to take a first crack at what you're the statist among us. What levers you want to push to make Johnny anti-vax get a jab?
I don't want to push any levers myself, but I do think that employers who have an interest in this have some levers they can pull. And that is why we are already seeing a bunch of big employers from grocery chains to McDonald's offering some form of benefit, whether it's cash or whether it's an extra day off or something like that, to employees who show proof of vaccination. And I think that doing this through private employer encouragement is actually a pretty good way to reach, especially people who need to be vaccinated to interact with a lot of people, say if you are a grocery store clerk, for your job. But the other thing that I think, in terms of government levers, there's a really simple one, which is the government could approve AstraZeneca, and they could do it months and months and months ago. And making more vaccines available and making it easier for people to get vaccines, especially I believe AstraZeneca is a one dose, and it's very inexpensive per dose. Whoever's paying for it, whether it's an insurance company or whether it's through federal funds or whether it's out of your own pocket, it's much less expensive than the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And that means that it's going to be a good vaccine or to get to hard-to-reach populations. It's also easier to store than the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which require, in some cases, special refrigeration. And so increasing vaccine availability, especially the availability of cheap vaccines, is going to help people a lot. And the federal government has just botched that for months and months now.
Catherine, should... I'm appealing to your Monday morning hatreds, as I always try to do. Should every GD teacher, public school teacher, be forced to get vaccinated, especially if they're spending their spring break on trips down to Mexico unvaccinated?
Do not like the word forced. Don't like the word forced. Makes me nervous. Don't use the word forced. But yeah, every GD public school kid already has to get vaccinated to go into that building, not for COVID right now, because COVID is not approved for kids. Oh. But all the other vaccines, like just a ton of them. And not only do they have to get vaccinated, you have to do a bunch of dumb paperwork to show that they were vaccinated. She said, literally staring at something in her inbox right now that is causing rage on that very, very front. Apparently, I need to go find the piece of paper that says my children aren't going to get mumps so they can go back to school sometime. Anyway, we've already established that entry into public school buildings being predicated on vaccination is a thing we do. You might not love that. You might think, hey, there could be better ways. But like, that's already a thing we do. And I think it would be perfectly fine to do that for public school teachers. You know what they could do if they don't want to get vaccinated? If they feel really, really, really strongly Ooh. About not getting vaccinated?
Tell them.
Get a different job.
Whoa!
That's what they could do,
Ohio,
seriously.
Governor Mike DeWine explicitly conditioned getting teachers vaccinated on a return to school by a certain date.
Right. But it's both directions, right? And I think, you know, this can be true for many professions, as Peter said. I would love to see employers incentivize vaccination, ideally, rather than, you know, punitively requiring it or even threatening firing necessarily. I think there are lots of ways to nudge without forcing, and better that the nudgers should be private entities rather than public. But given that we already have a big, dumb system where the government does school, in this case, the government may require people in its employ to get a vaccine.
Nick, it sounds like Catherine is entering the back door to private sector vaccine passports. What say you, Nicholas B., about vaccine passports?
I do want to, actually, even though I know that you were sort of joking, I do want to say, like, the private sector vaccine passport question, which has also now, like, spiraled itself a bit out of control. You know, there's a reason I said it the way I just did, which is that I think ideally subsidize, pay, nudge, encourage, make available, like all of those things, I believe will be enough. I don't think that we are probably going to need to get to a stage where we have some kind of uniform vaccine passport or even much of a private side piecemeal vaccine passport scenario, because we are an incredibly wealthy country that has a ton of available vaccine that people seem to be broadly interested in getting. But that will be luck. That will not resolve the underlying tension.
Matt, I think we can solve all of this if we just require proof of vaccine as a condition of voting.
Yes, you know what?
That should alienate mm-hmm. everybody in every way that we never yeah. speak of it again.
Something New York Yankee game too, which Rand Paul was inexplicably tweeting about earlier. Yeah.
You get a Ron Boomer Bloomberg bobblehead. He's got a book coming out over the summer about his relationship with Thurman Munson, the ill-fated, poor flying Hall of Fame catcher for the Bronx Bombers. I think just to be outspoken about this, I think the idea of anything related to a public, you know, vaccine passport is a horrifying apparition, because in the end, it's not about public health. We'll have reached herd immunity, et cetera, by all of this kind of stuff. And if any kind of government agency starts to condition things, and in a way, I would say this is true of public schools where you are forced to send your kids, or heavily conditioned to send your kids, you know, with the under penalty of law, to schools. Many people can't afford anything but public schools. And if you don't get this, that, or the other thing, you can go to jail. Most states do have exemptions for that. So, you know, which is good and all of that. But the idea of any kind of public sector enforced vaccine passport strikes me as terrifying. If private businesses want to insist on certain types of, you know, showing papers in order to come into the store and get a pack of gum and stuff like that, you know, that is, I think they're right. I think that will be, you know, much less widespread than people think. But the point of vaccine passports, when people are talking about this and showing vaccination papers, ultimately, I don't think it's about public health. I think it's about conditioning people to do whatever the state or an authority tells them at a certain time. And we should be pushing back against that in the same way. And this is where I tip towards anarchism, where I rarely do. You know, when you present for work, the fact that you are in the country, you know, and not under, you know, and not being handcuffed means that you should be assumed to be legal, you know, and ready and capable of working. And that's how the policy should be. We should have a free play zone once you're in the country. And the idea that you have to constantly be showing papers in order to work and things like that, when you're not committing a crime, when you're not doing anything wrong, when there is no reasonable suspicion that you're involved in an illegal or immoral activity, you know, leave it alone. And so, you know, this passport, in the same way that the lockdown under the guise of COVID and for public health is, you know, it might be a one-off, I hope it is, but it also might be a demonstration project for all other forms of social control. Even talking about these vaccine passport type things, I think, is going down a similar road.
The vaccine the vaccine passport discourse is also just an incredible example of politics as a lagging indicator, right? Like, actually, maybe some kind of system where you could show via universally accepted paperwork that you had a negative COVID test or that you were vaccinated 6 months ago might have been useful back when vaccines were rare and, you know, testing was available, but not broadly used or well implemented, though not as available as it could have been. Abolish the FDA. But it is now too late. And then we're going to have a big dumb fight about this, and it's going to be even more too late. And then it's going to be over.
And there are also just practical issues here, which is that a vaccine passport system that is set up by the federal government runs the risk of effectively becoming a kind of vaccine TSA, with all of the bureaucratic hassles, all of the expense, and all of the non-results that the TSA has given us, right? And what is the TSA? Does the TSA actually do a great job of keeping people safe on airlines and other forms of transportation? No. What they do is cost us a bunch of time and money. There's just a bunch of headaches. They're not effective. And I have to believe that even if you think the idea of a vaccine passport might be a good one, sort of in theory, right? The actual practical application of a federal vaccine passport system is almost certainly going to look more like the TSA and less like any sort of good system that is efficient and effective that you can imagine.
I assume we'll be taking off our shoes to go into bars soon.
Ew.
Tom Nichols would be really happy about that. Pursuant to...
I don't know what that means. I'm going to choose not to know.
I'm not sure.
Wait, what happened? So it's going to be no shirt, no shoes service?
Tom Nichols is infamous. He's the guy who wrote a book about the thing a couple years ago about experts and the war against
expertise. The death of expertise. What does that have to do with stockinged feet?
He always posts... whether his own pictures or other people's pictures on Twitter of the awfulness of people taking their shoes off on airplanes. Mm. Like America.
That is the Lord's
work. We need more experts to make sure that the shoes are on people's feet. But pursuant to Catherine's point about lagging indicator, Nate Silver, the former baseball nerd turned political prognosticator publisher, just tweeted out this morning that there are 222 COVID deaths reported in the U.S. yesterday, the lowest number since March 23rd, 2020. We will be like screeching at each other while hopefully in most of the country and hopefully in Michigan again soon, this stuff is going away. All right, let's go to our tail end of podcast discussion of what cultural products we have been consuming and entertaining ourselves with. Nick, would you like to start us off?
Sure. And, you know, I have a quick comment and then a recommendation. But the thing everyone should be consuming is the tightening of the camaraderie between the elite media and the Biden White House. And this takes, I'll just give two quick examples. And the first is the hilarious prank that Dr. Jill Biden played on Air Force One on April Fool's, where she came out and actually served some ice cream to the reporters in a disguise, wearing a black wig, a black-haired wig, and calling herself Jasmine, and then came back, revealed herself to be, no, in fact, it is I, Dr. Jill Biden, to the applause of the people on the plane, according to a pool report, which is sickening. I mean, it is like, this is like something out of the Hunger Games, you know, where it's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, you
that
know, it's just,
vaguely
it's
sounds
insane.
Like maybe cultural appropriation. Now that you say
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and it's also like, well, you talk about a captive audience, too. Like, it's like, oh, Dr. Jill, you are fucking funny as fuck when you are, you know, when we're flying 50,000 feet above the planet and you're giving us ice cream. My God, wow, you have a really good sense of humor, and that costume was just killer. But the other thing on CNN over the weekend, there was a great segment, which you can find at Tom Elliott's Twitter feed, who captures every horrible bit. But Jim Acosta of CNN is complaining about, like, why can't we just have a damn high-speed rail in this country? Why can't I please get to New York from Washington without problems on the Acela? And can I get the Wi-Fi on it, by the way? And it's
what?
Again, it's like, you know, you're on camera here. Like, it's this kind of, you know, simpatico. I mean, it's like the, it, you know, it's a French court, you know, a couple of decades, a couple of clicks before the revolution. So consume this all constantly, by which I mean, you know, read Twitter and watch TV. My actual consumption is the forthcoming book by Louis Menand, a literature professor at Harvard, called The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. It's a follow-up to his book, The Metaphysical Club. This is a massive kind of summation of the types of literature, music, film, other forms of creative expression that was produced in and consumed in the 20th century after World War II. It's not about the Cold War themes. The Cold War is important as a background context, but it's not an interrogation of that. It's a broad scope. And he says, you know, the broad theme of American cultural production was freedom. And what did it mean to come out of, you know, poverty, to come out of, you know, the Depression, World War II, the rise of civil rights, the kind of a delivery on a particular version of the American dream of mass democratic or democratized enfranchisement into being able to live your life the way you wanted to kind of really be an individual and figure out what you wanted to do, how you wanted to create meaning in the face of major institutions, whether it's churches or governments or businesses failing. It is a fantastic book. And he kind of posits that, to go back to the thing I was talking about, Amity Schles, it's like after a certain point, that theme of freedom is really important in the first kind of rush out of a system of oppression, which could be political oppression, it could be economic oppression, it could be ethnic oppression, it could be gender oppression. What happens when that initial kind of energy is spent? How does art change? How do the artists themselves change? It's just a phenomenal book, The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War by Louis Menand.
Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I watched Godzilla versus Kong on HBO Max. A lot of people saw it in the theater. That's great. This is the sort of movie that will be much louder in the movie theater, which is, I think, the main virtue of a film like this is that it's really loud. Even if you're watching it like, kind of quiet on your phone, it's just loud. I think actually the best way to understand this for the purposes of this podcast, though, is to compare it to Biden's big spending bills. It's really big, and it's been a long time coming, right? This is the fourth of the big monster movies in this legendary monster film series. I think it's also the weakest, right? It sort of feels tired at this point, even though it throws a lot into into the project. You know, on the one hand, unlike the recovery bill and the infrastructure or jobs bill that's now being considered, it actually delivers on what it promises in the title. There is a giant lizard and there is a giant ape and they fight each other and they punch each other a lot and they smash each other into buildings. It's not mostly about something else. It really is just Godzilla and Kong punching. But it's also really big and loud and completely unnecessary and sort of joyless. And I think there's a lot of inflation here that is going unremarked upon, as with some of these fiscal bills, right? Kong is just way too big. Like, historically, it is sort of in pop culture mythos, like in the realm of pop culture, Kong is not supposed to be the size of Godzilla. Godzilla is the size of a skyscraper. If you remember at the beginning, at the end of the Kong movie, he climbs
You're
the skyscraper.
Checking the size of King Kong.
Yep, he is.
What kind of film subsidy did they get from Georgia, Peter?
I actually don't know the answer to that question, but I really wouldn't be surprised if this were heavily backed by taxpayers who didn't get a choice. Anyway, if you like seeing big monsters punch each other in a sort of boring but very loud way, it's a great movie for you. If you want to go back to a movie theater and see something expensive, it's playing in theaters now, which are open in virtually every part of the United States. Again, finally, but can't really recommend it.
Catherine, what big lizard punching apes did you consume?
So really what feels like about 1,000 years ago, I contributed to a Kickstarter for a perfume that smells like space, which of course I did. And it was very unclear whether this perfume was ever going to arrive, not unlike commercial space travel. And it did arrive this weekend, and the box was kind of beat up. And when I opened it up, the label was kind of janky. And then I took the plastic off and it smells really bad. And objectively
space
bad.
Stinks.
And the pitch, the selling pitch, was intriguing. I mean, it was basically like space, according to people who have been in space, on the moon, in spacewalks, on the ISS, and somebody kind of collected all the adjectives, which included stuff like sweet-smelling welding fumes, raspberries, burnt steak, almond cookies. Like, there was, in theory, a really interesting, delicious scent there. But kind of like the romance of space travel itself, the idea of it is pretty poetic, and the execution of it came in late, more difficult than expected. And I think actually when we do all eventually end up with the opportunity to go to space, it's probably going to smell bad. Like, I mean, just like any of the forms of going to space, it's going to be like a bunch of people crammed in together, surrounded by chemicals and machinery in ways like it's probably going to smell bad. So I would say for me, the Ode to Space Kickstarter was both wildly disappointing and also helped me reset once again my own expectations for the future of space travel downward, while still not abandoning them entirely, since it actually showed up.
Were there like astronaut blurbs? People who have been to space attesting to the spaceness of this particular smell?
And I think that is because, honestly, again, this whole thing seems to have been run utterly a shambles. I think they pulled quotes of people saying what space would smell like from publicly available sources. I would be pretty surprised if any actual astronauts ended up endorsing this product. I brought
that
it into the office
like
to test in case I was just having a bad nose day or something, and sprayed it on Robbie Suave, and he's really mad right now.
If his hair falls out, you are to blame.
God.
Yeah. I was going to make an economic modeling joke, but I'm not now. Before I go into mine, I'm going to take the moderating privilege by just sharing with you all a New York Times tweet that went up 32 minutes ago saying, breaking news, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Monday argued for a global minimum corporate tax rate. as the Biden administration looks to fund its infrastructure plan and prevent companies from shifting profits overseas to evade taxes. Good idea or the best idea, Catherine?
That idea smells like Ode to Space to me.
Perfectly put. My cultural consumption is a Twitter thread, and that's not me being lazy. That's me laughing out loud like seven different times during a very satisfying and entertaining thread from Ben Dreyfuss, son of Richard. Two S's on the name. The thread began innocently enough on April 1st. As follows. And Ben is he's a former social media editor at Mother Jones. Now he's kind of floating in the stinky space and funny guy and like the only pro Biden person during the entire 2016 or 2020 campaign season that you could find on Twitter. He was the one. Anyways, moderate for Mother Jones. He said, "I like that people care about trains, but have you guys ever been on a really long train ride? It's not great. I've taken an Amtrak across the country, and it's really not an ideal way of doing that." Okay. Ben is a funny guy, and he also says sort of like common sensey things, some of which are common sense and some of which are not at all. But he continued that the funny thing happened is that all of the lefty train enthusiasts who went to, you know, Paris that one summer came at him, and he just got increasingly crazier and humans have mastered flight, and buddy, it's amazing. He then said that the single worst experience of my entire life was taking a train from New York to Chicago in just a normal coach seat. Everyone by now is losing their mind. And then he just keeps on going, why are people still tweeting at me about how they love trains? I don't care. I'm not trying to take your precious trains from you. I keeps going. I mean, if you want to take some slow way across the country, Godspeed, buy a fucking ox and get pulled across for all I care. It becomes libertarian nirvana by the end of this, where he wants to abolish trains and bury them and all the people who like them. Super funny, makes you laugh. And if you come across it and you retweet it yourself, your inbox is then going to be filled with people who say stuff like, "That's just not funny. That's not funny. We have to dream higher." And it's just all comedy gold.
Matt, did you go to voice camp on your vacation?
Outer Banks,
you
man.
You seem to be doing a lot of voices today.
It's a refresh on my voice game, going to North Carolina. Discovering for the first time that the Delmarva Peninsula, mm-hmm. Do you know why they call it Delmarva?
I think.
It never occurred to me.
Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia.
Yeah.
Wait.
It's just on one peninsula.
I went four levels higher. I was like, yeah. I mean, it's just the abbreviation, but is there something else going on? Like, I thought you were bringing us some real insights here. No,
it's like that like town on the border of Alabama and Florida, Florala.
Yeah.
No,
or
really?
Texarkana. Matt, why do they call Chick-fil-A Chick-fil-A?
Over Chick Corea's Scientology?
Probably. It's the smooth jazz of chicken sandwich.
Why is the town
Xenu.
The town
Xenu is risen?
Where Pete Welch used to work as an aerospace engineer, Azusa, called Azusa. Fun fact. Because the town fathers thought that it was going to be A through Z USA.
No.
Get out.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's really? Like one of those like apocryphal, like the kid whose name is like L-A pronounced Ladasha. Like that does not sound real, what you just said.
Yeah, it might not be real, but that's what we told ourselves.
It's too good to check, Matt. It's like, you know, when Cher saw Mount Rushmore and she said those mountains look just like people. It's too good to check.
That's all the share quotes we have time for this week on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening. Keep sending us your queries at roundtable@reason.com. That was another voice, Nick, if you noticed.
Yeah, I don't. I want you to do a robot. Can you do like a robot butler for next week?
Listen to the Reason podcasts at reason.com podcasts.
A comical Nazi in the bunker with Hitler.
No,
including Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays.
No,
on the interview.
I'm no longer on this podcast. I checked out. to be clear, several minutes ago, so I'm not responsible for anything that has happened here.
It's been a long pandemic, is what I'm saying. It's over.
Yeah, but you got some fried
it's time
founder.
To break free.
Show us your papers, Matt Welch, before we believe it's over.
Yeah.
Nothing is over.
Nothing is belief. Okay, goodbye.